Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Agent Chat Live. Agent Chat Live is a spin-off of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about both shows, visit pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake and Reframe. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Agent Chat Live. We're going to get started in just a minute, but I have a couple announcements first. So you may have seen on my channel on Thursday, I am launching a new podcast, and it is called Queries, Qualms, and Quirks, and it asks published authors to share their successful query letters and discuss their journey from first spark to day of publication. So if you haven't checked that out yet, there's an announcement on my Patreon, on my website, on YouTube. So you can see that information there. And then also on Saturday, we have Pub Talk Live this week with guest co-host is going to be EJ Wenstrom. And my special guest is Gabriella, who is the founder of DIY MFA. So make sure you come back on Saturday, 9 p.m. for that. So hello, I see y'all coming in. Hello, Savannah. Hi, Lodestar. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guest today. Devin Halliday joined Transatlantic Agency as a literary agent in the summer of 2020. She's been involved in the publishing industry since 2015. And before coming to Transatlantic, she's worked as an agent and a scout. She's now building a list in literary and upmarket fiction, as well as nonfiction focusing on contemporary internet culture. She has a BA in comparative literature from Brown University, and she lives in her hometown of Athens, Ohio. So please welcome Devin. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me in this virtual space.
Thanks so much for coming on. I just realized you're in Athens. My cat is named Athena, so I feel like we have a connection there.
That's an auspicious connection. Good omen.
And also, there are links for Devin in the description right now. So if you're watching live, they're there now. If you're listening to the podcast, they're in the description there. So make sure you go check out your website, your profile on Transatlantic, and your Twitter account. So
yes. Cool.
All right. So my goal here is to help potential clients get to know you a little bit better. Viewers are welcome to drop questions in the comments, but I did want to say, starting off, that we won't really be asking any questions that like a Google search or any agent can answer, things like word count and genre definitions. And I also won't be asking what I like to call pre-queries, which is like when people ask you if you'd be interested in, for example, mermaids in space, which is the example that I've been using for a long time. And then I found out recently one of my friends has a book that's mermaids in space.
Wait, but there's no water up there. So that's already
a conflict
in the story. The mermaids have the antagonist, which is the reality of space. Sounds compelling.
Well, there's also no air up there, so I guess.
Right. That's fair. A lot of antagonists.
All right. It's okay, Liz. Sorry, I got your Patreon question. So that'll be in the thing. So you're good there. All right. So Devin, to start off, a really softball question here. What categories and genres do you represent?
All right. You sort of summarized them yourself earlier, but yeah, literary fiction and upmarket fiction and narrative nonfiction, creative nonfiction, investigative nonfiction. I'm sort of flexible about category. I really go for writing first and foremost, but some of the things that appeal to me are anything speculative, whether it's magical realism or alternate timelines. I like the geekier side of speculative, so like video games, virtual reality, reality TV, all that stuff is fun. I also just tend to like, in general, moral gray zones, I guess, and characters who are flawed in ways that, the conflicts arise from the flaws instead of just being like an external plot forced onto the characters. The character can't exist as they are in the world and they need to change in order to be in the world. I think that's always fun. Well, maybe not fun, but always transformative and useful. Exactly. Yeah. In addition to that, I always go for a love story, whether that's in the form of a rom-com or like a love story element in a larger story. As mentioned, my nonfiction right now is really leaning towards internet culture, just because I feel like we live on the internet and it's really hard to document it. There are so few writers who can write about being online. Like, you notice in so many novels, characters like don't have cell phones or like aren't on Twitter for 12 hours a day. Which is good for the sake of plot, but like also I feel like we need to acknowledge that this is where we spend a lot of our time. Yeah. So those are some instances. I have like a list on my website of other categories that interest me. But yeah, overall, if the writing is good and original and surprising, I'm there for it, even if it's not a genre that I typically do.
Cool. All right. So why did you get into agenting?
I had a fortunate path to agenting, which started with my very narrow range of skills, which is that couldn't do math, couldn't do science, couldn't do history, didn't have much of a memory. And so, yeah, like reading and writing is sort of all I did growing up. It was what I liked best and it's what I did best. And so when I got to college, I was like, all right, I'm aware careers in this field can be tricky. I'm going to call everyone who's ever worked in anything adjacent to reading and writing, and I'm going to see what they do. And so through these like informational interviews, I talked to some literary agents and I was like, huh, everything that they do sounds cool and fun. And I want to have a cool, fun job. So how do I get to where they are? So from there, it was just a path of internships and like kind of learning the ropes. And I told myself at the outset, like, all right, I'm just going to keep doing this until it stops being fun and until I lose interest, and then I'll find another career. Here I am. So obviously, it was love at first sight, I guess. I love editorial work and I get to do a lot of that as an agent. I find the relationship building side of it really fun. I find the people really nice and smart. I love everything about this career.
Nice. All right. So this next question has a little bit of a preface, because I find that if I just ask it straight out, people are too humble. So I'm giving you a chance to brag about yourself. So please take full advantage of it. If someone is thinking about querying you and your wish list lines up with their work, why should someone query you?
Yeah, I think that I'm going to focus on the editorial side here because I think that's really vital. And the reason I think that is because at the end of the day, agents can't sell your book. Like, your book can sell your book, right? I mean, the agent has to get it into the right hands at the right time with the right context, with the right enthusiasm. But if the book isn't good enough, it's still not going to sell, right? There's only so much the agent can do. And especially with a competitive market that we have now, I think it's vital that agents can edit as well as just, you know, matchmake. And I love editing and I'm obsessive about it. And I think that that's sort of one of the strengths that I'll bring to the team as an agent for my clients who sign on with me. Because, you know, I think there are different levels of editorial work that agents are willing to do. And with me, you're not going to get handed off to an assistant or an intern or a freelance editor, no matter what shape your manuscript is in, because I wouldn't have signed you if I didn't think I could handle whatever you're putting out. And I really love the kind of detailed work that makes a book better, even in the small ways, besides just like fixing a crazy plot. You know, like my comments in the margins of your manuscript are not going to be like, unclear, rephrase. They're going to be like, oh, I noticed that in the last paragraph we used a water metaphor, but in this paragraph, this adjective seems sort of fire-leaning and it's causing a bit of confusion. Like, maybe we could make that in line with the water from the last paragraph. I really like getting into the weeds of that sort of discussion, and I'm willing to do that throughout. I think that I never underestimate how important it is to have a polished manuscript, and I'm definitely going to be there for every step of making it as good as possible.
Nice. So this is another question with a caveat. So a lot of this question gets asked this way: if you had a magic wand, what would you change about the industry? But me being a pragmatic person, I get really frustrated by that question because we don't have magic wands. So realistically, but also kind of, you know, pie in the sky, if you were, say, you know, the CEO of Penguin Random House, Simon Schuster, which we're, I think, about to have in a year now. What change would you make about the industry? What big thing do you think you would change?
Yeah, realistically, but optimistically, I think the easy answer is I would get rid of blurbs because I don't like blurbs and I think we should get rid of them. And that's a more realistic side of things. Yeah. Nobody likes them. They're stressful for published authors. They're incredibly stressful for debut authors. Nobody means them. It's just like endless posturing at this point. And yeah, it's. I don't even think readers care about them that much. I don't as a reader. Get rid of blurbs. But if I had to pick something that's maybe a little more wide-ranging. I guess I would want the mid-list titles to come back, and I'd want editors to have the freedom to acquire things that weren't already successful. You know, so much of the industry is driven by like, oh, this did really well 2 months ago, therefore it must be what we're going to need in 2 years. And there's like I feel like originality gets a little bit stifled there. And personal taste can get kind of squashed down if everyone's just trying to find something that seems like a bestseller. So yeah, I guess I would just, as a president or CEO, I would just be really rich and then therefore allow all of my editors to acquire whatever they wanted.
Nice. Yes, the guys at the top get paid quite a bit more than it seems like everyone else.
Yeah, there might be money somewhere that could be reallocated.
Yeah. All right. So when you sign a client, what can they expect after that? You kind of talked about how you're very editorial, but you know, even beyond that, what does the process look like and what kind of communication style do you have?
Yeah. So I think the first step, probably if I've already, you know, had the phone call with the client, we've talked about editorial stuff. We've talked about next steps and we've talked about their goals for the book and for their career. So we both have like a starting idea of where we want to go. So yeah, my first step is usually editorial, whether that's like, you know, a big macro edit to fix some sort of problems or aspects of the book that aren't feeling as strong as they could be, or whether the book is like in incredible shape and we're just going to go straight to copy editing, which sometimes happens. So as that's happening and as the author is working on a revision, that's usually when I'm building a pitch letter and a sublist. I like to draft the pitch letter from scratch and like, you know, spend part of my day just brainstorming adjective combinations to make the book sound as brilliant and breathtaking and et cetera, as it could possibly be. And then I'm also putting together a list of editors that I want to go to. A lot of these will be people that I've met with before and that I'm familiar with. And there will also be some new people on there just to add some random chance to it. And then as we get closer to the end of revision and I get the sense that we're going to go out pretty soon, I start setting up meetings with the editors on the list. And those will be pitch meetings for me to talk about the book and sort of give them a positive feeling about the author before they even receive my submission. And from then on, it's go time. Basically, we're in submission land. We don't have a lot of control over how fast that's going to go. But I try to sort of stay flexible and expand the submission whenever we want, you know, instead of doing like, this is round one and round one will be over when the last editor says no, you know, I'm like, no, come on, we're just gonna keep sending it out. And, you know, hope for a lucky break. And yeah, so I think communication wise, I'm fairly flexible on that front. I like to sort of tailor it to whatever my client requests. I have some clients who want to know absolutely everything that I'm getting up to and others who are like, yeah, tell me when you sold it. Like, I don't want to hear about rejections. Don't tell me. So I'll do whatever the client prefers. I think that for more creative sides of the process, I do phone calls. Like I like to do a title brainstorm before we send it out. Just to see if there's like a brilliant title that we can come up with. And then for simpler things, email is fine by me.
Are you good at titles?
I try really hard. I'm of the opinion that like, if you do an hour long brainstorm, something good is going to come of it. Nice. Even if I go into it with dumb ideas.
Nice. I am so bad at titles. I've never titled a book. And the book I'm writing now, I'm like halfway through and I don't have a title. And I just feel like I have no idea. So like, you know, if you want to brainstorm titles.
Absolutely. It's fun for me. Do you want to share a previous terrible title that you used to think was good for a former book? Or is that like classified information?
I don't know. So I have one book that is Dragons Are People Too that mm-hmm. my friend came up with the title, and actually she suggested the title. She was like joking and acting like it was a book that already existed. And then that actually gave me the idea for the book. And amazing. I was sure the publisher was going to change the title because I thought it sounded more middle grade than YA, you know? And they liked it. So they kept it. And then Keeping Her Secret, it was part of a multi-author series, so I knew I wouldn't be able to title it any because they, you know, they want to match the titles, right? And so I didn't even think about it because I was like, I'm not going to title it anyway. I won't be able to come up with anything. My editor came up with a great title. It has a double meaning. So Yeah. And then, so I also self-publish, right? And my first it was self-published. It was with a publisher first. It's a Hansel and Gretel zombie retelling. And I had a title for it, but I knew that it was not a good title and that it shouldn't keep that title, right? Mm. And it was called Hag.
Okay, I like that. It doesn't imply Hansel and Gretel retelling, but yeah. I do like it as a title. One word, punchy, powerful, a little grotesque. It's nice.
It was a romance.
Okay. Yeah, so so not ideal.
Yeah. So my publicist actually came up with the title for that. And it was funny because the publisher didn't like it, but everyone else on the team loved it. So that's what we went with. Yeah. Anyway, that was a whole tangent. Sorry, y'all.
No, titles are interesting. I mean, you know, from my perspective, of course the publisher's going to change it. I never get attached to any titles I come up with. And so whenever I do this brainstorm with the author, I'm saying, like, I don't care what the book is ultimately called. What we need to do is get this slightly higher in the pile of reading that the editor has on their desk. And so, mm-hmm. like, it's purely editor-facing at that point. We're not trying to appeal to readers. We're just like, all right, do we think that Joe will like the sound of this book? If not, let's fix the title. Which kind of helps, because I feel like you can get bogged down in choosing a title. Like, it has to capture the soul of your book, and it has to, like, say everything that you've ever wanted to say. And so I come in and I'm like, no, this is purely monetary. We're just going to pick a title that we think will sell.
Yeah.
And then after that, we can add in the beautiful thematic, you know, long-winded title that you came up
with. All right. Lodestar said, are you good at pen names? Poor Lodestar has been trying to come up with a pen name for a while now.
Oh man. Pen names are so personal. I feel like I probably would do a brainstorm with a client, but I would hesitate to suggest anything.
Yeah,
when I was, like, in elementary school, I came up with some good pen names for myself. So, you know, I could pull out that list and share it.
Yeah, I love doing names. I love coming up with names. So speaking of Lodestar, we have a Patreon question. So my Patreon supporters can submit questions ahead of time for the Agent Chat Live and Pub Talk Live. And Lodestar wants to know, what is your favorite philosophy? He also actually asked it in the comments, so I'm going to pull it up. What is your favorite type of philosophy? Or psychological theory, I guess.
Okay, so I'm suspecting that this question arises from me having studied comparative literature. So I kind of want to set the record straight. Yet there is a theory to comparative literature. I didn't really do that. I sort of did all possible electives to avoid theory. So I know very little about actual philosophy and psychology, though if someone has a good book on those that is suitable for a layperson, I do want to read it. But I will say that in high school, I read On the Genealogy of Morals by Nietzsche. And I know that Nietzsche is a bit of a controversial figure, but at the time I thought it was really cool that his argument was, like, you know, the set of values and morals that we have in society has been inherited and passed down to us and is a little bit arbitrary, and, like, it's okay to set up your own value system. And so I was interested in that as someone who didn't quite understand the arbitrariness of the ethical world and, like, sort of wanted to make up my own rules. I mean, I really can't speak to anything else Nietzsche has ever said or done, but I thought that was a good book.
Nice. Do you know the podcast, The Happiness Lab with Lori Santos?
I do not. I'm not much of a podcast listener. Can't multitask very well, so.
Yeah. She did a mini series that's like, I forget what it was called, but it was Secrets to Happiness According to the Ancients. So she did, she spoke with experts on, like, Plato and Socrates and all these ancient, you know, philosophers. And it was really interesting. So just heads up if anybody's interested in it.
I probably should listen to that. And the next time someone asks me about my favorite philosopher, I'll have a gorgeous answer, scripted and rehearsed.
Yeah. Sorry. All right, so it is time for the quick round. So it's just a couple questions, give quick answers to. The first one is our last question with an intro.
All right.
I don't know why I have so many questions with intros, but this is the last one. So when I was coming up with the title for the show, as we discussed, I'm terrible at titles. Pub Talk Live had already been going on for a while, and so I asked my Patreon supporters if they had any suggestions for the name. And
I told them what I was wanting to do, and I think it was Lotsar. Lotsar, could you finally correct me if I'm wrong on this, who suggested snack time with an agent, which I thought was fun because it was like the kind of casual atmosphere that I wanted, but I also thought it might imply that it was only for kidlit agents.
Yes.
So we went with Agent Chat Live, which better fits the brand. Okay, it was you. Good, cool. So, but this question remains from that title. What is your favorite snack?
Granola. I'm addicted to granola. I know that's, okay, so it seems a little pretentious and like bougie, but I make a giant batch of granola every week and I sort of live on it for the rest of the week because it's like cereal, but I get to still pretend that I'm healthy while I eat it. And yeah, I don't know. It's like I'll have it for lunch and dinner some days because I'm like, oh God, cooking, that takes so long. Who has time for that? Not me. Guess what I have time for? Granola every day. So yeah, love granola.
All right. So it's both your favorite snack and meal, apparently.
It's my favorite object in the universe. It's the center of my world.
Wow. Nice. What is your preferred caffeine source?
I'm going to say something a little sacrilegious here, and I apologize for it, but I want to be honest with you because you've kindly invited me to do this. I drink decaf, coffee and tea. And the reason for that is that I really like coffee and I really like tea and I want to be able to drink them all day. But if I drink coffee all day, I end up a jittery mess and then I have like headaches for weeks. And so I learned early on that if I drank decaf, I could have like 6 cups of coffee and I would be fine. I'd barely, tiniest buzz. So yeah, I go for decaf. I'm a supporter of decaf. And I won't apologize for it.
Let me ask you this question. I used to work at Starbucks. Do you drink the decaf at Starbucks? Decaf espresso?
No. How is it? Is it horrible?
No, it's the decaf and espresso, because the espresso at Starbucks is so caffeinated, the decaf is still pretty caffeinated.
Yeah.
Like, I think I heard sometime, I don't know if this is like technically true, but it's at least close to true that a decaf latte from Starbucks has as much caffeine as regular Maxwell House.
Yikes, that's terrifying. Okay.
Yeah. So don't get it there.
I have
so
really
people with like
tolerance.
Medical issues with caffeine, they can't have the decaf at Starbucks.
Oh my God. Yeah. I have an embarrassingly low tolerance for caffeine. Like I'll have 3 cups of decaf and my husband comes home and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so hopped up on decaf right now. Like, don't talk to me. I'm shaking. So it's kind of for my own health also that I stick to the tame stuff.
Okay. Lozar said, I actually wanted to call it tea time with an agent, but I know some people aren't tea fans. He's talking about me. I'm not a tea fan. Mm. Yeah, that's funny.
Like you're against tea.
I'm not against it, but we have this argument a lot on my channel, like coffee versus tea. And I don't like tea. Like I have to put so much sugar in it for it to make it drinkable to me. But I'm also a super taster, and so bitter things are hard. But I used to work at Starbucks, and so I just got like, I didn't like coffee at first when I started working there, but I just got accustomed to it. And now I love it. All right, do you have a word that you irrationally hate?
Yes, sob.
Sob.
I hate the word sob. And well, okay, we might say it's irrational. I have some reasoning for it that I think is sound, which is that I think it's in novels, it's often misused and it often feels corny or excessive. I feel like I can't remember the last time I read the word sob in a novel and felt that it was earned. Like I'll see it a lot in query samples where like a character dies on the first page and someone's sobbing and I'm like, whoa, like I'm not ready for sobbing. You maybe have earned that by like the second to last chapter, but it's too soon. So yeah, my authors know that I will try to cut out excessive displays of emotion wherever they occur. And I feel like it's, for me, it's because there's often more pathos in like a character being stoic than there is in a character just like emoting wildly, you know, like instead of, you know, she closed the door and she sobbed, you can have like, she closed the door, she sat down, the night lasted a long time. And you're like, okay, like, wow, it's been all night. Maybe she's been crying. I don't know, but she's sad. So yeah, I feel like words like that often appear in corny ways, tend to upset me. Also, my most irrational hatred is probably yearn. I don't like the word yearn. And it's for some of the same reasons. Like, it often appears in a place that it shouldn't be, but even when it appears correctly, I'm still like, it's not a pretty word. You know, it means something like beautiful from the heart. You crave something, but yearn, it's like the most kind of American ugly. It's just not a good sound. I would get rid of it if I could. I try to, and then my clients have to fight me and put it back.
This is so good. I think this is the best answer to this question I ever got.
I have a lot of irrational hatred in me, so, you know, I could do this all day.
All right. Is there a TV show or movie that you'd like to see rebooted?
Ooh, rebooted. As in like redone or added onto?
Either, yeah.
I'm probably going to have the same answer as everyone here. I mean, I think Russian Doll and Fleabag are both stellar. And I think Russian Doll is getting another season and Fleabag is not. So I'm 50-50 there, but I'm basically happy with that result. I really loved Sherlock, BBC Sherlock. So obviously still holding out for that fifth season. It's going to happen. Don't burst my bubble. yeah, I think those would be my three.
All right. And do you have a favorite superhero?
I think I have a relative favorite. I'm not willing to defend him to the death, but I think that compared to the others, Iron Man is probably my guy for the reason that he's a self-made man. You know, like, he invents his own superpower, which is cool. It's not handed to him. It's not accidental, but also he doesn't invent it and start doing heroic things until like the last possible second. And he does it to save his own skin. And I feel like there's like a laziness and a procrastination there that we can all relate to and learn from. Like, he's not going to be heroic until he has to do it to get out of danger and then like accidentally save the world. But it's just, you know, it's purely a last minute assignment that he completes, which I'm into.
All right, Abigail asked a question. Very easy, I'm sure, to answer. What is your favorite book?
Oh God. Okay. All right, I got this. Okay, so I'm gonna say something not super kosher, given that I'm not a young white male, but I really love Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace.
I knew you were gonna say as soon as she said
I know. Look, it's just like, I read it and like it sort of changed what I thought fiction could do. And so like, of all the books I've read, I think it's had the most lasting impact as far as like, oh, there are more options than I realized. You know, this genre is bigger than I thought it was. And like, there's a lot of unexplored territory and that's cool. I want to move towards that. But if we're talking recent contemporary books that are not hailed by young men on Tinder, then I'd probably say Patricia Lockwood's book that just came out, No One Is Talking About This, is fantastic. And it's like, it's sort of, you know, a novel in vignettes about the internet. And like, yeah, she's one of the few people who can capture what it's like to be online. It's super quotable. You're going to want to just like text your friends quotes from the book. she's like scary smart. And yeah, it's a great book and has a surprising second half. And it's just really good.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out. All right, so that's the end of the quick round question, which turned out to be a conversation section, but it's fine.
Oops, sorry.
No, it's all right. I can't remember who it was. One of the questions, we ended up going on this like 12-minute tangent. You know, whatever happens, happens. This is a casual sort of show.
You're not going to have like a timer ticking down in the corner to let me know that I've spoken too long?
Yeah, no buzzer.
All right.
All right. So what is your single best query letter tip?
Oh, okay. My best query letter tip is stop working on your query letter and work on your sample pages. And I think that's really important. I think the importance of the query letter is overestimated. You know, sure, there are some great query letters. There are some terrible ones. Most of them fall in the middle where it seems like a respectable idea for a book. Sounds cool. Can't tell if it's going to be good. I'm going to check the sample pages. Like, literally how I review queries is to skim the query letter. And if the person seems like a psychopath, I'm not going to keep reading. But if they don't seem like a psychopath, immediately cut to the sample pages. And the reason for that is, you know, every book idea sounds pretty good and I don't want to get my heart set. You know, sometimes you'll read a wonderful query letter and it sounds like mermaids in space, like beautiful. Like, this is everything I've been waiting for. And then sentence one of the sample pages, you're like, oh, they haven't read any book before in their whole life. And like, you can know immediately. And so I am always skipping to the sample pages. And if I read those and I like them, then I go back to the query letter and I'm like, okay, what's this book about? So yeah, I think that a bad query letter, as long as it's not like crazy bad, is not going to disqualify you, but bad sample pages can and will disqualify you. So yeah, work on those, get some beta readers.
So just curious, when you said it sounded like they had never read a book in their life, did you know that last year I went viral for telling people who want to be writers to read one book?
I didn't know that, but that's very good advice.
People got really, really mad. Well, because what I said was read one book published in the last 5 years. And apparently I am single-handedly destroying literature. So
cool. Ooh, yikes. Okay, so yeah. I've just replicated your mistake and you didn't stop me.
I know.
You're supposed to give me a little signal. Like, stop. Okay, well, yeah, my career's over. But it was fun while it lasted.
So it's like a joke now on my channel. Read one book. I have a t-shirt that says read one book.
I mean, it's just like, it's partially reading books and also kind of being aware of the conversation and the context into which you're going to be published. Because like, there are really common mistakes that get made by a lot of query writers. And so if I see that you're making one of those, it just tells me that you haven't really put in the time to do research, and maybe the book will be great in a couple of years, but I doubt it's going to be great now. And so, yeah, it's just like, don't make it easier for me to skip past your query, you know, like really work on those sample pages. Everything matters. You know, it's the first page of your book. Like every little sign is pointing to me either like, oh, I'm pleasantly surprised, or like, yikes, that was a little sexist, you know? And like, it's kind of a tally that happens in my brain of like, oh, plus one, that was a cool phrase. Minus one, dimly lit, you know, plus one, interesting character moment. Minus one, this was a dream sequence, you know? And like, eventually it evens out to a score.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that was great. A little reliving of last year. What is your favorite thing about being a literary agent?
I really value the relationships with authors. I guess that's probably a typical answer. Maybe I should try to think of something more original.
I like it. No, it's a good answer.
No, I mean, it's really a unique relationship. I think it starts out very businesslike. Both parties are trying to impress the other and like sound professional. But after you've been through a couple revisions on the same manuscript and you're both exhausted and like sick of the characters, you know, it turns into more of a friendship, kind of a bond. And so it gets all around more kind of flexible and candid in a way that I really appreciate. And that's when they can start saying like, yeah, you're right, I should do this revision, but here's the problem, I hate my book. And I'm like, I get it, but I don't hate your book. And we're going to get through this and it's going to be fine. Yeah. And those conversations are also really fun. I mean, even like trying to untangle a really thorny problem in a plot is fun when you're both like, you have the same goal and you're bouncing around ideas and there are no stupid solutions. And yeah, it's a good time.
Yeah. All right. So this question puts you a little bit on the spot. Feel free to just say, no, okay. I'm not answering that, Sarah. Do you have a good literary name for a cat or a dog?
Oh, goodness. Good literary name. I'd probably just take something from Shakespeare. Like a cat named Benvolio seems kind of funny to me. I would name a cat Benvolio because then you get to like nickname it Ben and then people are like, oh, Benjamin? No, Benvolio. yeah, I think just go back to Shakespeare. That he's got a lot of good names.
That's a good answer. Yeah. All right. I think I just have one last question for you, unless anyone in the audience has a question. What are the last couple of books that you read that you really enjoyed? You gave us one of them, but.
Yes. I'm currently reading Fake Accounts by Lauren Euler, which is really good. Also in the space of like millennials talking about the internet, because I have a niche. but actually that it's funny that I mentioned sob earlier, hating that word. And there's a really good passage in Fake Accounts, where the character is like, I was crying. I wasn't sobbing, wailing, thrashing around on the floor, screaming my head off, like beating my brow. You know, she lists all of the other cliche things she could have said. And then she's like, I was just crying. And it's a really classic moment because it gives you a sense of the character. but it also is the writer kind of winking at you like, yeah, I know you've seen all these synonyms before. Like, I'm not going to use them. I'm not going to bother. Anyway, other books. I just reread Trust Exercise recently, which I really love. I just read The Parable of the Sower, finally, after many, many, many years of it being recommended to me. I've been on kind of a fiction kick lately. Before that, I read a couple memoirs before that. So The Recovering by Leslie Jamison is really good. And then I also read, what's it called? Captive Audience by Lucas Mann. And that's a book about reality TV. I don't know if you've read it. Also,
I've read it, but I've heard it. Yeah.
It's like a hyper literary memoir about TV and existence, which I enjoy.
All right. Well, cool. Devin, thank you so much for coming on today and answering my questions and helping readers get to, or writers get to know you a little bit better. I'm just going to remind everyone, Thursday, Corey's Qualms and Quirks launches.
Great title, by the way.
Thanks. It took me a while to come up with it. the first author is going to be Cass Morris, by the way, who is a historical fantasy author. I had a great time talking to her, so hopefully y'all like the episode. You can find it on all major podcast apps, and it will also be syndicated on my YouTube channel if you just want to do it here. All right, I think that is everyone. Devin, I will talk to you after in just a minute, so hang out for a minute.
Sounds good.
But everyone stay safe, wash your hands, wear a mask, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.